And I'm gonna upset some people here in the community, but I think you and I probably share the same opinion that this tool is way more important than Reboa. Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hello again, this is Dan Godby, Medical Editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for the Winter 2021 edition of the JSOM Podcast. For this issue, I will again identify some articles worth reading that will not be covered by Josh and Alex in the podcast. As an EMS medical director myself, I particularly like the article, Emergency Medical Services Provider Self-Reported Occupational Safety. My hope is with this research being published, it will lead to a broader nationwide study, and I feel a nationwide survey would benefit this area. Next is the article, The Myths of Uncontrolled Emergency Reactions in Consideration to Stop Mandatory Protocol Midazolam Co-Administration with Ketamine in the Pre-Hospital Setting. Finally, Asymmetrical Loading Patterns in Military Personnel with a History of Self-Reported Low Back Pain is of interest to me both personally and professionally. This article is worth a read for everyone who serves in or cares for members of Special Operations Units. As always, we at the JSOM are interested in hearing from our readership, especially those of you in the primary positions. And I'd like to reiterate our recently developed mentoring program specifically to help medics get through the publishing process. Now, here's Josh and Alex with the podcast.
And Josh, welcome back, my friend. So nice to chat with you despite our many delays, most of which I think are attributed to me. We were supposed to be doing this technically last year, but here we are, end of January, with some recordings finally.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I had to cancel on you for at least once because of noisy neighbors, which are the chickens. So, you know, it's better to be late than not at all, right?
It wasn't the baby pygmy yoga goats this time?
No. It might have been, it could have been the guinea hens, honestly. Those suckers are loud too, but the chickens are the most notable on recording, so.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, pivoting to something more meaningful, you know, I recently returned to my civilian hospital, and we are just getting absolutely crushed right now with COVID patients, which is having a really dramatic impact on the entire flow of the hospital. All of our elective surgery cases have been canceled, so we're doing emergency surgery only, which is fine if your job is emergency surgery. And, you know, my patients are taking almost a full day to get up to the ICU from the ER. And we are probably not far away from enacting actual crisis standards of care because of the onslaught and burden of the patients that we're dealing with. And it actually reminds me of soft medicine and the soft medic practice, because I think really over the last 20 years, when people have been dealing with high volumes of severely injured trauma patients with new capability that we've never before seen, folks may or may not have realized that they really were in the crisis standards of care, just doing the best they can and then passing along those patients when able. I think we may have crested a new hill in terms of patient care and flow going forward, because none of us really anticipate in the near-term future with high volumes of critically injured patients, but instead it's probably going to be more of a slow trickle. And so really, once we're able to conscientiously pivot out of a crisis standards of care, that's when we're able to spend more time reaching out to colleagues, consultants, and other subject matter experts to help facilitate taking care of our patients. And that is especially true now, thanks to Colonel Pamplin and the rest of his all-star team with their advisor system. And this really came home recently when I was helping a role one care provider take care of a patient who had some complex disease processes, and they were fully qualified to take care of that patient. But, you know, I was pushing really hard to loop in some expert consultants that were not in the immediate area because we did have the capability and we did have the time. And so just like with surgery, when we're always taught just because you can do surgery doesn't mean you should do surgery, I think we really need to reframe a lot of our thought process for some of our forward soft medical assets, that just because you can take care of a patient by yourself and you have successfully for many, many years, now that it's slower and we have the time and we have the capability, you don't necessarily think that you should have to take care of that patient all by yourself, which is a really significant paradigm shift in terms of our training and our thought process. What do you think?
Yeah, Alex, absolutely. But I think we need to expand your thoughts to even a wider base. Based on my experience when I deployed to Africa, there were a ton of times that I had to call for help just to make sure there was an optimal outcome for the patient, and also to determine evacuation resources, like if I needed to have that person leave right now or if I could wait for 1 to 2 weeks for the next flight out. Asking for help is really important. It saves lives, it optimizes outcomes, and it really helps managing resources. And I think all levels of providers could really, really do well to hear the recommendation you're making there.
All right, so first up, we've got another case report. And so this is the use of walking blood bank at point of injury during combat operations by a whole slew of really great authors, Matt Gaddy, Alan Fickling, Vanessa Hanick, and of course, Stacy Shackelford. So the abstract on this does a great job summarizing it. U.S. military TC3 guidelines recommend blood products as the preferred means of fluid resuscitation in trauma patients. However, most combat units do not receive blood products prior to executing combat missions, largely due to logistical limitations in both blood supply and transfusion equipment. Further, the vast majority of medics are not trained in transfusion protocol. For many medics, the logistical constraints for cold-stored blood products favor the use of walking blood bank. However, few cases have been reported of walking blood bank implementation at the point of injury during real-world combat operations. This case report reviews one case of successful transfusion utilizing a walking blood bank procedure at point of injury during combat and highlighting not only the feasibility, but also the necessity for implementation of this practice on a larger scale. Right, so this is just one of those things that makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up to read through this particular case report. So I definitely don't want to steal their thunder and would very highly recommend that the readers actually read through it. But the 30,000 foot view is there was an ODA in southwestern Afghanistan in 2018. They had some organic medical assets as well as some other special operations medical assets. They note that on initial ground movement, they were engaged by a barricaded shooter, as well as taking a fragmentation round with multiple initial patients. That one was critical, one was a walking wounded. The initial care on scene was quite impressive. I moved the patient to the CCP, had a shift to right on the timeline for their medevac, which we all know is what happens. Made the decision to do a walking blood bank, implemented that program at POI with really impressive improvement in the patient vital signs and clinical presentation. Matter of fact, you can see here that from the beginning of the collection process to the end of giving the first unit was a total of 15 minutes. I mean, that's just outstanding. And then fortunately, they have some of the follow-on care at Roll 2 and Roll 3. And again, I don't want to steal the thunder, but just to give a level of severity here, when this patient arrived at the Roll 2, he was found to have a grade 5 splenic injury. And Josh, how many grades are there of a splenic injury?
Well, I mean, if I use both hands, there's 5, Alex. There's 5.
Right. So the organ that's designed to have all of your blood go through it, that has 2 units of blood in it organically, was basically obliterated into the equivalent of hamburger, if we're going to use non-clinical terms. And these medics at POI kept this guy alive and to discharge using this walking blood bank. The authors, I think probably with the assistance of Dr. Shackelford, also do a really nice job writing up their discussion and conclusion as well. This also happens to be a testament to what other medics, in my opinion, should look at as a template for writing a case report, which JSOM is always interested in. I will say they mention that there is limited safety and efficacy of fresh whole blood and the walking blood bank in the literature. And of course, Josh, as you and I have spoken about in the past, there is another JSOM article that has gotten a lot of traction in this particular field. And I will point folks back to that one, which is The Risk Associated with Autologous Fresh Whole Blood Training by a number of very smart folks that are friends of you and I. And this was back in 2019. This particular case report, as well as that previous article, continue to show just how important of a tool this is for our point of injury special operations medics, and I sure hope that we continue the momentum of bringing this over to conventional forces, because as this case report shows, it does wonderful things for our critically injured patients who are at the tip of the spear. What do you think, Josh?
I've seen really badly injured people come into trauma bays, and what a difference a couple units of blood can make in just stabilizing them so that either one, they can get to the OR, or two, maybe they don't need the OR. So for everybody, walking blood bank is really important. Even if you don't feel comfortable sticking the arm, get your procedures in place, break your systems and fix them and make them work, because this stuff really does save lives.
Next up, our associate producer, Rico, has our guest editor spot with my good friend and colleague, Pete. Take it away, guys.
All right. Today we have Pete, who is a Special Operations Independent Duty Corpsman, who's been a medic for almost 15 years now, mostly spent time on the soft side of the house, and has deployed to CENTCOM, PAYCOM, AFRICOM, and NORTHCOM. Welcome, Pete. What do you have for us today?
Hey, Rico. Thank you for having me on the episode. I'm super pumped to be part of the podcast today. Okay, so the study we're reviewing today is an original research and is titled The Comprehensive Ultrasound Course for Special Operations Combat and Tactical Medics. For a quick summary, there was a highlighted need for ultrasound training for soft medics at the point of injury, or POI. A group of doctors, providers, both military and non-military, created a one-week course to standardize familiarization, function, and knowledge of the use of typical variants of portable ultrasound machines seen at the soft medic level. The subjects of the course were 9 soft medics. The course consisted of an online read-ahead module prior to the course, the live instruction to include a lecture and workshop, which was the majority of the course, with some exams and assessments before and after.
And what gaps in the literature were the authors trying to fill, or what clinical questions were they trying to answer?
Sure. So basically, the authors identified a need for a baseline of skills and application of ultrasound for the soft medics. And they tried to answer, is there a course for these end users or soft medics that can meet these needs or skills and hit the mark? And the authors wanted to design and implement a comprehensive training program for soft medics to improve knowledge, application, and workflow understanding of ultrasound at the POI or nearest POI. Some other underlying questions: what are those key diagnostic findings for soft medics at the point of injury? Course teaches efficient exams of the heart, lung, kidneys, liver, spleen, abdomen, all to look for internal bleeding, reduced cardiac function, pneumothoraxes, and even bone fractures. And the course also allowed for ultrasound-guided interventions such as central venous line placements, IV access, and regional nerve blocks.
Very interesting, and sounds pretty awesome. What sort of methodology were they using?
Okay, yeah. So the group tested the knowledge and manual skills of the subjects at the beginning of the course for baseline reference, completed another knowledge and manual skills test at the end of the course, and then compared to the results. Subjects also took a pre- and post-course exam on the ability to correctly diagnose ultrasound findings and were graded individually by experts on manual skills. They also participated in a 2-hour objective clinical skills exam at the end of the course on using appropriate steps and identifying correct diagnosis based on ultrasound findings and images that they were shown. The before and after manual skills and knowledge tests were averaged and compared as well. So for results, based on expert ratings, manual skills, workflow understanding, and the average comfort level of the soft medics, showed that they improved significantly from their baseline. The average score of every station was above 91%. And from the authors, they were able to reach the goal and demonstrate a successful implementation of an ultrasound course for the intended soft medic audience through the multimodal methods of online, didactic, and hands-on instruction.
And what do you think some strengths of the paper were?
So some strengths, the subjects were the intended end users aimed to improve their knowledge, skill, and application. There was a focus on assessing the critical manual skills and knowledge of ultrasound specific for the end user, and the analysis of knowledge, skills, and application prior to and after the course, which ultimately proved successful for this cohort.
And of course, every paper has a couple weaknesses. So what were some of the weaknesses for this one?
Okay, yeah. I think the consideration of operational settings for training during the course, clinical versus austere, they both do have their differences, as well as the study needed to be a little more broader within the soft medic community, meaning NSW, MARSOC, USASOC, and AFSOC, although the study does highlight that the sample size or the diversity could have been broader. Finally, where did this data come from to identify the gap?
And do you think the study meets requirements to change clinical practice at all?
Yes, I think in my opinion, the methodical approach of sustainable prereq online reading, live lecture to detailed and sustainable hands-on training and tests to prove efficiency shows the multimodal course was not generic, but specifically designed with the soft medic in mind. And then finally, the study gets a C on the Statler-Waldorf scale.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Pete. Ultrasound in soft medic's hands is a very powerful tool. So I appreciate you summarizing this paper for us. And thanks for being on the pod.
Absolutely, Rico. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So this article is a combination article, and it's about stress inoculation training. The first part was the development and preliminary evaluation of a psychological performance training protocol. And the second part was titled, A Pilot Study Among Explosive Ordnance Disposable Special Warfare Enablers. The authors were Sarah Jackson, Matthew Beatty, Patrick Thomas, et al. I'll quote from their background. Health and human performance professionals aligned with the warfighter community are facing an inevitable truth. There is not one but two battles. The first is defined by the ability to fight, survive, and accomplish the mission within the crucible of warfare. The second, to survive the long-term physical and psychological injuries characteristic of their sacrifices and thrive against the odds. The current studies propose a strategy for the warfighter alignment on both battlefields. Stress inoculation training is a training protocol that has been in place for a long time. Rand has studied stress inoculation training and described data that suggested that individuals can be trained to minimize the deleterious effects of stress on human performance. There have also been other studies reported that after stress inoculation training, it can be considered a second-line treatment for PTSD, and this is data out of the VA. So the preliminary aims of this project included exploring the acceptability, feasibility, and impact, including both content and process elements associated with SIT and NORCAL, along traditional military training and simulation capabilities. That being, in part one, they discuss developing this protocol. And then in part two, they describe a group of EOD airmen going through the training and how it helped them. Given the findings of the RAND study, this SIT NORCAL was developed for United States Air Force Special Operations and Combat Medics. You can read in part one about the data and the experts they drew to build this protocol. However, I'm going to move on to the second portion, was where they tested this SIT NORCAL protocol. So a USAF EOD team was utilized as subjects during this pilot study. They were engaged three times during unit trainings from 2017 to 2019 about SIT NORCAL. They provided information and recommendations for content improvements in the core training modules. This population was tested with the Wilder Collaboration Factors Inventory, which is used to ID strengths and weaknesses of their collaborative groups. The investigators also measured the human performance targets before and after training to track improvement. Heart rate variability was used as feedback to increase physiological awareness in response to training, And lastly, a training satisfaction questionnaire was developed by the investigators based on a previously validated client satisfaction questionnaire. The training sequence is described in many pictorial references, which you can go look up on your own. And they had a total of 10 participants, and they were all from the same unit. So within this pilot study, all areas measured showed improvement after instruction. Of note, they improved time-based efficiency, and more participants spent more time in the heart rate variability optimal zone of biomechanical regulation. The satisfaction questionnaire suggested that participants seemed to enjoy this training. In discussing this article, I don't have a lot of experience in human performance, but this is very positive. It is a pilot study. There's a small population. It needs to be tested on a larger group of folks for longer periods of time, and they need to be followed for probably several years to make sure that not only does it work in the short term when they measure it, but also over the years as things go along, and perhaps decide how much retraining will be needed in order to maintain these positive effects. The authors also recognize that better measurement instruments are needed, and this is something that they're going to have to work on. You have any thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, I'm just most appreciative of the fact that you got that article and not me, because that was, what was it, like 10,000 words or something?
It was a total of 26 pages on one and 18 on the other. It was not short.
Yeah, I'm really glad you got that one. You talked about how this was a pilot study. So what grade of evidence, as we promised our readers we would be doing, do you think this is?
So I believe, Alex, it's grade 4 evidence.
Oh, so probably not ready to change practice?
Not ready to change practice, but keep your eyes on the future, everybody. This may come to a unit near you.
Before it's ready to change practice. Well, Josh, despite being incredibly late, I think we finally got through it. That's another wrap. So on to lighter news. Anything new and exciting in your world?
So I just recently took advanced hazmat life support. I don't know if you knew, there's like so many more advanced whatever life supports out there. And it was interesting. It's always a good time. I mean, you got to remember that phenol is a painless burn, but hydrogen fluoride likes to take your calcium. So in case you're curious, guys.
That sounds like good advice. I think my mom told me that, actually. And Yeah, that's a great reminder, because I've actually heard that that is a really good course, and I've also heard it's really hard to find and get into. And so just as a reminder to everyone, there is a rumor that our outstanding lab coordinator at SOMSA is actively trying to get that class at SOMSA this year. It is not yet confirmed. Please don't hold me to that. But I know they're working really, really hard to try and make that happen. And please, everybody out there, we would love to see you at SOMSA this year. So put it on your calendar, ask for leave, hopefully ask for funding from the unit. SOMSA 2022 is going to be May 2 through 6 at the Raleigh Convention Center in Raleigh, North Carolina. With that, anything else you got, Josh?
No, Alex. It was good to talk to you, man.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.
This is Colonel Shackelford from the Joint Trauma System reminding you to submit your DD 1380 and TC3 AAR to JTS after the mission.